Hey, Cliff Goldstein here, and welcome to the program, which today is about the revolt of Frenchman Albert Camus. And what was Camus revolting against? Well, it wasn't a political revolt like the French Revolution or the American or the Russian. It was a revolt against something much deeper than politics. It's what he himself termed a metaphysical revolt. Let me quote you from the opening chapter of book two of his book called The Rebel. Listen to what he says. Metaphysical rebellion is the movement by which man protests against his condition and against the whole of creation. It is metaphysical because it contests the ends of man and of creation. The slave protests against his condition in which he finds himself within his state of slavery. The metaphysical rebel protests against the condition in which he finds himself as a man. The metaphysical rebel declares that he is frustrated by the universe. Now, whoa. I mean, it's a revolt against the universe. It's a revolt against the whole of creation. That's pretty intense, is it not? I mean, you know, it's one thing, a slave revolting against his master, or the poor rising up and revolting against the rich, or the people rising up and revolting against their king or their czar or whatever. But here is a man who's declaring his revolt against the whole of creation. What is going on in here? What's this all about? Well, let me read you a little more from Camus' The Rebel so you get an idea. Here we are, same book, The Rebel. He says here, quote, the rebel opposes the principle of justice which he finds himself to the principles of injustice which he sees. Let me read it again. He opposes the principle of justice which he finds in himself to the principle of injustice which he sees being applied to the world. In other words, he's rebelling against the injustice that pervades human existence. Now, notice something interesting here. He talks in this quote about the principle of justice that he finds within himself. That is contrasted with the incredible injustice which he sees in the world. Now, that's interesting because it raises the question of where did he get this sense of justice in himself to begin with? You know, is it not kind of strange that humans should have this sense of justice, of right and wrong? I mean, where did they get it from? At least in a godless, amoral universe that was created purely from amoral entities like quarks and gluons, or even higher things like hydrogen and carbon, how do these things, immoral in and of themselves, how do these things over time eventually create moral beings? But anyway, that's another talk completely. But for starters, though, Camus is rebelling against the injustice of this world. That's part of his metaphysical revolt. Well, what else is he revolting against? He says here, meanwhile, the rebel denounces the contradiction. Metaphysical rebellion is a claim motivated by the concept of a complete unity against the suffering of life and death, and a protest against the human condition, both for its incompleteness, thanks to death, and its wastefulness, thanks to evil. Okay? So, he's revolting against a number of things here, against evil and suffering, which he implies causes our life to be a waste. In another essay, in another book, Camus talked about once he said the uselessness of suffering. And you know, I think Camus has a point. Given his premise, Camus is working here, at least from a purely physical view of the world. Now, what do I mean by that? You see, for most of human history, in theory, at least history as we know it, there were two basic views of the world, of existence. The first view is what I would call the metaphysical view, the idea that there's a deeper element of reality than the purely physical. It can be called the religious view or the faith view or the God or God's view. I mean, this is the idea that we inhabit a universe that's not just the physical elements, the natural elements we see, but there are supernatural elements as well. It's the idea of a two-tiered reality, that reality has a spiritual dimension. This could also include the idea of divine justice, of God, divine judgment, an afterlife, heaven, hell, whatever. And this is a view that I think for most of the human world has held for most of history, no matter how radically those different views were. Now, in contrast, there's what I call the physical view. That's the view that many today's intellectual hold, a view that has a history, but is really, you know, much more prevalent today. And it's basically simply, you could say, it's the atheistic view. It's the view that claims all reality, all existence is purely physical, purely what once ancient Greek once called matter in the void. It's pretty much a mechanistic, naturalistic view, doesn't allow for God or the supernatural or for any kind of afterlife. It's the view which limits existence to here and now. It could basically be summed up by Karl Marx's friend Ludwig Feuerbach, who once said that man is what he eats. Okay, and I think that's, you know, a good way of expressing that view. Generally, those who hold to this view are atheistic evolutionists, accepting the idea that we're here purely by chance, a freak action of nature in a vast cosmos that didn't prepare for us, that didn't anticipate us, and that frankly doesn't really give a hoot about us. And that, I believe, is the view that Camus is working here. For most part, I don't know if you call Camus an absolute hardcore atheist, though he certainly leans that way. And I think it's funny that he would call his thing a metaphysical revolt when it's really kind of a physical revolt, because he's working from the purely physical view of reality and the limitations on it. If it were truly metaphysical, he might not have the problems, but we'll get to look at that. Anyway, Camus was wrestling with the question of evil and suffering, and hence our lives seem so much of a waste. Why is that so? Well, look at it like this. You know, I mean, as human beings, we are capable of feeling and knowing an immense amount of joy and happiness, are we not? I mean, you know, think of the pleasure that we can derive from our senses alone. The potential for ecstasy is there. It's dangling before us all the time. I mean, the potential for purely physical pleasure is enormous. Look at what our senses can offer us, you know, with sight and with taste and with touch and smell and sound and music and food and sexuality and smells and the beauty of what we can see and sense. Just imagine what our lives would be like. Were we able to fully enjoy all these things the way that we could? Yes, there's no question the way we are created and the way the world is outside us, this contains the potential. And notice when I stress on the word, the potential to give us all a great amount of pleasure. Now, that's just the physical element. There's also the whole other element of relationships. Again, I'm dealing with the potential. Think of the incredible pleasures and enjoyment that could come from relations. Parent to child, sibling to sibling, spouse to spouse, friend to friend. I mean, most people to some degree have already experienced some of the great pleasures that these kind of relationships can give us. I mean, it can be wonderful. You see, so the question, there's no question that potentially human life offers us so many joys, so many pleasures, so many good things. See, that's the potential. But what is the reality? Well, the reality is of evil. The reality of what we potentially can have and what we really have, man, that's vastly different. I mean, the senses and the emotions that can be, that offer us so much goodness, happiness, and pleasure, so often are ruined by pain, suffering, sickness, and evil, and sorrow, and on and on and on. You know, all these things are in us that are part of us that could, under the right condition, do so much good, give us so much good, have done the opposites. Our senses make us miserable oftentimes, and so many relationships do too. And this is what I believe Camus is rebelling against. We have these lives so full of the potential for joy and pleasure and happiness, and instead there's evil and it ruins it all. You know, it's one thing to live a full, happy, and complete life and then have it end in death. But to live a life of pain, sorrow, suffering, disappointment, and on and still have it end in death, it's such a waste. And that's what leads Camus into his other metaphysical revolt. And that is the revolt against death. I mean, good luck revolting against that. He says, He says right here, he says, quite simply, he blasphemes, talking about the rebel, quite simply, he blasphemes primarily in the name of order, denouncing God as the father of death and as the supreme outrage. Yes, the rebel rejects his mortality. He refuses to accept the condition that leaves him facing the death sentence. This is what he rebels against. We go through life and we go through this life and all the injustice and all the evil, and then we die anyway. No wonder he wants to rebel. Who can blame him? I mean, it's worth rebelling against, isn't it not? Now, let me read you through one more quote here. Let's just go back to this quote again. So notice that quote that I just read. He blasphemes primarily in the name of order, denouncing God as the father of death. So you see, notice something here with this quote. Camus is leaving his options open. There might not be a God, but there might be a God. So we're stuck with this mess here. We're stuck with this mess of no one really to blame. Things just happen to be this way. That is if there is no God. On the other hand, there might be a God in which the metaphysical rebel is a blasphemer, and he's cursing God, blaming him as the father of death, because the rebel, in another place, he talks about how he rejects his mortality. Now, heavy stuff, I admit it. And Camus is dealing here with what he called the absurd, which for Camus is the great divide between what the heart and mind and soul of humanity wants and what it gets instead. It's a rebellion of the potential, because he sees the potential, against the actual. It's a rebellion of the hope of the possible against what's real. The rebel rebels against the contradiction between his sense of justice, the justice that he finds in himself, and the incredible injustice that he sees all around. He rebels against the great divide between the potential for human joy and happiness that's wired in our nerves. He rebels against that and the reality of the evil and suffering and pain which he sees everywhere. That's what he rebels against. And he rebels against the reality of death, the eternal finality of death. The fact that death threatens to make all that came before it useless and meaningless. This is what Camus' metaphysical revolt is about. This is the cause of the rebel. But see, I asked the question, but now what? The rebel revolts against these things? And so what? And what? It's one thing for the French revolutionaries to overthrow, Louis the 16th and Marie Antoinette. Can't say what they got was any better, could you? The Bolsheviks revolted and overthrew the Tsar. Okay, can't say what they got was a whole lot better anyway, could you? And for sure, the colonists overthrew the British rule. And certainly you could say that what came out of America was pretty good, but it still didn't solve the metaphysical problems that Camus was dealing with. You know, it didn't still solve the problem of injustice and death, did it? It's kind of funny that he would label his revolt a metaphysical revolt when it really, it seems to be, it's more a physical revolt. He's revolting against the physical limitations of the world. He's operating on the premise that there is nothing transcendent above the world. This is it, period. You know, in his book, The Myth of Sisyphus, he once made the quote, he says, but I do not know. He said, let me read here. He said, I don't know whether this world has a meaning that transcends it. That's pretty heavy. In other words, that's it. He doesn't know if there's a metaphysical realm. He doesn't know these things. He's saying it doesn't know if this exists or if it exists. And he doesn't know the meaning of it, even if it did. He's open to the possibility, but without knowing it, he's left with nothing. In another place, though, I think he catches the essence of his revolt and the essence of all the futility of everything that he's struggling with. He says, this world has a higher meaning that transcends its worries, or nothing is true but those worries. Let me read that again. The world has a higher meaning than, higher meaning that transcends its worries, or nothing is true but these worries. Wow. That's it. Here he expresses it all in a nutshell. Unless there's something transcending this world and all its sorrows, then all that's real is this world and its sorrows. And if that's the case, there's nothing else but this pain, suffering, and all this. That's all that there is. Then what a bummer. And that's the great irony, the great contradiction in his thinking. As long as this metaphysical rebel rebels against only the physical realm, as long as he acknowledges only this physical realm, his rebellion is futile, it's useless, he's kicking air. He's rebelling against axioms. His rebellion is doomed to failure. The rebellion itself, instead of becoming a solution to the problem, becomes just another manifestation of the problem. The rebellion becomes something to rebel against itself because it offers no answer to the solutions that it struggles with. Because evil hasn't gone away. Injustice hasn't gone away. Suffering hasn't gone away. Death hasn't gone away, despite all of Camus' bemoaning. And if humans were one day able to get rid of injustice, get rid of evil, which doesn't seem likely, there's still the whole question of death, which threatens to make it all meaningless. Hence the revolt of Albert Camus. A pretty futile revolt, I'd say. Words, protestations, demonstrations, picket lines, whatever. But a revolt doomed to fail based on the very terms of the revolt itself. Now, all this leads to something very interesting for me and very personal. I basically grew up with the same worldview of Albert Camus. I had what I talked about earlier, the secular physical view of the world. Humanity is what it ate, period. And so, you know, having been kind of hewed and chiseled on this skepticism, I found in the writings of Albert Camus someone who could, with quite a bit of eloquence, express the passion, the fear, the exasperation, and the pain that came from living in a world that, by its cruel and arbitrary nature, demanded many answers but didn't render any. I want to read you something that I wrote probably 20 years ago about Albert Camus' influence on me during my college years. This isn't a book I wrote, but this is the influence of Camus on me. Albert Camus is my Horace, chief deity in my expanding pantheon of philosophical polytheism. He asked all the right questions, expressed all the right fears. In Camus, I see myself stomping the ground and shaking a fist at the sky, except that he does it so eloquently. But amid all his beautiful prose, I find no answers. He only better defines my anxiety. He opens up my wound, shows me clearly my pain, but leaves me bleeding worse than before. In The Myth of Sisyphus, he writes, "There is only one real serious philosophical problem, that of suicide. To judge that life is or is not worth living, worth the trouble of being lived, that is to reply to the fundamental question of philosophy. Again, it's so negative because he's staging a metaphysical revolt in a world he's accepted only as physicals. The answers he wanted and needed couldn't come from the parameters he set for himself, the parameters he constantly believed it would be constrained by. It would be like someone living in a two-dimensional world of length and width, seeking an answer that exists only in the third dimension, that of height. Now, all of this leads to my point. In the year 2000, an old retired minister named Harold Muma shocked many folks, myself included, with the book he wrote called Albert Camus and the Minister. This is the book, Albert Camus and the Minister. Now, putting aside, he had some pretty goofy things in this book. Putting all that aside, there's one part in here that absolutely fascinated me, that caught the interest of the world when this came out. According to Muma, in the 50s or early 60s, whenever, I don't remember now, Camus had visited this church. Apparently there was somebody going to be playing the organ. Camus wanted to hear, so he visited the church, and he heard this pastor preach, and he liked the pastor. He liked the preaching. And according to this minister, he and Camus started a series of private conversation. And Camus told him just how discouraged he was with life, with suffering, with his inability to answer the deep questions. You know, here's a famous writer, wealthy, he's got everything, and yet he can't answer these questions. And again, there's no surprising he couldn't answer these questions, because again, you can't stage a metaphysical result in a purely and ultimately physical universe and succeed. You're looking for answers where they're only questions. The answers you want aren't where you're looking for them. Now, here though is the fascinating thing. According to this minister, he had a number of private conversations with Camus, and he had Bible studies with Camus, which is interesting. Albert Camus having Bible studies, well, anything could happen. But the part was, according to this minister, in private, Albert Camus came to him and said that he asked him about the meaning of baptism. The minister explained it. And according to him, Albert Camus said he was ready and he wanted to be baptized. Now, folks, Albert Camus wanting to dedicate his life to Christ and to be baptized, I mean, it would be like the president of Iran, you know, wanting to convert to Judaism and taking on Israeli citizenship. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, when you know about the writing and life of Albert Camus and you know what he taught and what he, you know, expressed his whole life, suddenly for him to want to get baptized? And yet, you know, here's something, though, folks. I believe it. I believe the story. I believe it with all my heart. And here's the reason why. When I read Camus as a young guy, I sensed the depth of his sincerity, the depth of his desire for answers, for truth. I sensed in Camus a fellow seeker. He was truly seeking for answers. He was truly seeking these things. And you know, there was a time in my life when I was truly seeking too, without believing I had any. You know, I mean, he was a seeker. I could see that. And my God promises me that if we seek him with all our hearts, we shall find him. And that's what I believe happened to Albert Camus. He wanted answers, and God gave them to him. The rebel revolted against injustice. Well, you know, the Bible promises a final judgment and promises that in the end, justice will be done. Not in this world. It's obvious you're going to have no justice now. I mean, if you're looking for justice now, folks, forget it. And if your rebellion demands that you have justice now, forget it. It's doomed. Because the answer is not in the physical, it's metaphysical. It's beyond this world as it is now. The rebel rebelled against evil. God promises to end evil and to justify his ways before the universe. That's what we look forward to. That's where the answer is. Not in this world, not in anything we could do here, not in science, but in God, who alone created life, who alone could stop death, who can stop the injustice and the evil. The rebel rebelled against death as well. Here too, over and over, if you read the New Testament, Christianity promises an end of the whole issue of death. It promises to destroy death. It promises to bring death to an end forever. Here's where the rebel can find answers to his revolt. Again, it doesn't come a revolt against the world. It doesn't come, but it comes in a surrender to the God who created this world. Now, as I said, this pastor had some pretty ridiculous things in the book. And all of them, one of the dumbest was his belief that Camus committed committed suicide in the car wreck that killed him just a few months after he was baptized. Camus never advocated suicide, never. He just asked the question of what's the purpose of trying to live a life that has no meaning. That's all. But the point is, and I truly believe this, that Camus, is because he was a real seeker. I sense that. I know that. I just knew it years ago. He was a fellow traveler, a fellow seeker. Camus was on the track. He was seeking answers, and he was on the track to finding the answers to the hard question. And he was finding them in the only way he could, and that was in the metaphysical realm. That was in the spiritual realm. That was in the realm of God and faith and of Jesus. That's where he's not going to find him, in the world in and of itself, because the world doesn't present the solution to the problems. The world is the cause of the problems. The world is the problem itself. But Camus never ended up getting baptized. Not that I think it totally matters. He died in a car wreck just a few months after he had that meeting with the minister, and in which he said he wanted to be baptized. And how absurd and, you know, his death, at least if this world is all there is, if there's nothing beyond it, as he believed his whole life. But, and I believe this to be true, that he began to see where the answers really were, and he was reaching out for them. If so, then his death, however tragic, was not the end of the story. It only closed a short chapter in what promises to be a very long, glorious, and happy story. You know, I'm not surprised about Albert Camus. As I said, I'm really not, even though people were shocked. And when I first heard this, I was shocked, because Albert Camus wanting to be baptized. I mean, the man spent his whole life shaking a fist up at God and shaking a fist at these things. But as I said, I'm not really surprised as I thought about it, because here was a seeker. He was someone who wanted to know truth. He was rebelling against the world as it was, and we ought to rebel against the world as it was, because the world, the way it is now, isn't the way it's supposed to be. And he was starting to find this truth that he was seeking. He wanted to know truth, starting to find it. The man who once wrote, "The silence of the universe has led me to conclude that the world without me was without meaning," had apparently, amid all that silence, begun to hear some answers after all. And he was getting the answers from a different realm, beyond the physical realm of the physical world he was struggling with. He was finding the answers in a realm above it, in the metaphysical realm, the realm of God and Christ, where the only answers are.